It's Friday, November 22nd, 2013. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Today, the 22nd of November, marks the 50th anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in Dallas, Texas. That event not only shocked both the nation and the world, the shockwaves are being felt even now. What happened in Dallas on that tragic day 50 years ago was not the first assassination of a United States president, but it was the one that happened in the modern media age. And it happened before a crowd of those in Dallas who were watching on the parade route and those also who soon saw the unforgettable images that took place on the television screen. To be human is to be possessed of a memory. And America's memory on the assassination of President John F. Kennedy is vivid, and it is tragic, and it is very intense. It is hard for most Americans living today to go back into the context of the Cold War and the way that America understood itself and its place in the world back in 1963. It's hard for most Americans to remember what it was like for the United States to pass through the political transition to having elected its first Roman Catholic president, to have elected a young veteran of World War II, to have elected a glamour couple who were well understood to be amongst the elite of American culture. And yet the assassination of John F. Kennedy 50 years ago also brought about more massive transformations of American society, or at least signaled their arrival. The transition in the presidency was from John F. Kennedy to his vice president, Lyndon Johnson. Johnson, who had previously served as majority leader in the United States Senate and as a senator from Texas, almost assuredly would never have been elected president of the United States in his own right. He was reelected after serving the remainder of John F. Kennedy's unexpired term. It is hard for most Americans today to imagine the kind of political rhetoric that surrounded John F. Kennedy, especially coming from conservatives and especially within states such as Texas. Dallas, Texas itself was a hotbed of opposition to the president. And yet, as Nellie Connolly, the First Lady of Texas, commented to the president shortly before the shots rang out, the adulation of the crowds in Dallas, as in Fort Worth, indicated that the president and the First Lady were actually very popular, indeed beloved by many in the city. The estimates were that 3 out of 10 of all residents of Dallas turned out to see the motorcade as it wound its way through the city. Of course, as we now know, that motorcade was actually a trail of tragedy. And the gruesomeness of that tragedy, the assassination of a president of the United States by gunshot, shocked the American mind and continues, as we have said, to send shockwaves through the American conscience. And yet our memory also sometimes fails us. There are those who look back to the political controversies of the 1960s and suggest that it was a liberal-conservative battle, the context of political division that led to the assassination of the president. But that was not so. President Kennedy was not assassinated by a political conservative, but by a Marxist who believed himself to be acting on behalf of communism. Lee Harvey Oswald was himself an actor of the Cold War. He was a man of the left, not a man of the right. And we seem sometimes to forget in America that the Cold War was not only a war of influence around the world fought by the United States and its allies over against the Soviet Union and its bloc. It was also a matter of the internal political conflict in the United States as well as in many European nations. Lee Harvey Oswald, so far as the Warren Commission and subsequent investigations have made clear, acted alone. And yet, Americans are also very much prone to believe in some form of a conspiracy theory. 50 years after the assassination of the president, these conspiracy theories continue to expand and to survive. Many observers looking at this have pointed out that the very existence of conspiracy theories points to the need of human beings and the human intelligence for rationality and explanation. It is hard for us to imagine that a single individual acting out of a single individual's motivations could have pulled off the assassination of a president of the United States. But in retrospect, we also understand that the presidency was not seen then as it is seen now. As columnist George Will has pointed out, several things have developed the office of the presidency into a more monarchical form and style, but one of them was the Kennedy assassination. Understandably, in the aftermath of that tragedy, the American president began to be more and more separated from the American people. Since then, it became inconceivable that a president would appear in public in a motorcade in an uncovered automobile exposed to the public. George Will went on to explain that another event, September the 11th of 2001, also continued the process of separating the president from the people. It was in the aftermath of 9/11 that, for example, Pennsylvania Avenue was closed to traffic in front of the White House, and barriers began to move the American public even further away from the executive mansion, from the White House. It is now in the aftermath not only of the Kennedy assassination, but subsequent assassination attempts on Presidents Gerald Ford and Ronald Reagan, that the American president has been further distanced. Evaluations of President John F. Kennedy now are greatly different than they were in 1963 and for the decades that immediately followed the tragedy of his assassination. The national trauma was such that an entire aura built up around John F. Kennedy, and his first lady, Jacqueline Kennedy, and the Kennedy administration. That aura was largely orchestrated by the president's widow, Jacqueline Kennedy, later Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, who began to speak openly of those Kennedy years as Camelot. The political dynamic in the United States is also vastly different from what it was in the 1960s, certainly in the early 1960s. President Kennedy was a Democratic president who defeated the Republican nominee, then Vice President Richard Nixon, in that close election in 1960. But in retrospect, it becomes more and more clear that Richard Nixon was actually the big government candidate in 1960, as opposed to John F. Kennedy, an advocate of a smaller government. In fact, there are those who argue that in the current political scene, John F. Kennedy would be seen as a fiscal and governmental conservative. One of the vast cuts in the capital gains tax in American history was undertaken by President Kennedy over against Republican opposition. The tables have turned since then. It is impossible to discuss John F. Kennedy without the moral and character issues that are now known. One of his most prominent biographers, Robert Dallek, has pointed out that President Kennedy's health was hidden from the American public in a carefully orchestrated system of dishonesty. The president himself was often gravely ill. At various points in his life, he had actually been administered the last rites, and yet the American people were shown what was believed to be a picture of robust health in an amazingly young and apparently vital president. But John F. Kennedy was also known for his extramarital affairs and for his affairs before he married Jacqueline Kennedy. It is now well documented that during World War II, John F. Kennedy had an affair with a woman later revealed to have been a Nazi spy. Even in his White House years, he was then known to have had an affair with a woman he shared as a mistress with a mafioso, a mob boss. There's been a major change in the American presidency in the fact that back then, the press cooperated in covering these extramarital affairs when it came to President Kennedy. Most of them came to light to the American public, in fact, all of them, after his assassination and in the midst of the development of the myth of Camelot. As historian Doris Kearns Goodwin recently commented, it is now inconceivable that an American president would survive the inevitable scandal of such dalliances and affairs once they became known. And the intense likelihood is that they would become known now because the American press has been changed utterly in terms of its relationship with the presidency, even with a very popular Democratic president such as John F. Kennedy. The response of the press to the sexual scandals surrounding former President Bill Clinton made that point very clearly. The 50th anniversary of John F. Kennedy's assassination also raises the inevitable what-if questions of history. What if the president had not been assassinated? What would he have done in the remainder of his first term? Would he have been reelected to office in 1964? Take away the assassination, and it is virtually impossible to imagine a President Lyndon Baines Johnson. What about the war in Vietnam? What about the civil rights movement? The what-ifs continue, and yet this much is abundantly clear. There is no way to answer the what-if questions. History is not a matter of what-if, even though our imagination inevitably raises the questions. History is a matter of what actually happened. America is a very different nation than it was in 1960. The great moral revolution we are observing in the current generation would have been inconceivable back in that period, let's remember, just 15 years after the end of the Second World War. That was the year that President Kennedy was elected in 1960. Just 3 years later, that administration came to a tragic end in those shots ringing out in Dallas, Texas. 50 years later, those alive on that sad day and those born since must be united in the knowledge that this great tragedy helped to transform the nation. And as we look back to that tragic day a half century ago, we also come to the recognition that events of this magnitude continue to shape us even now. Meanwhile, thinking of that half century anniversary of tragedy, we need to recognize that John F. Kennedy was not the only famous person in the world to die on November the 22nd, 1963. Dying on that same day were C.S. Lewis and Aldous Huxley. You're looking at three very significant individuals, three individuals whose influence continues still, but not equally. As a matter of fact, one of the very interesting debates that has taken place in American culture and in the media in recent days is the question of who had the longest surviving influence. Was it John F. Kennedy or C.S. Lewis? Clive Staples Lewis was a British professor, a professor of literature, a specialist in medieval literature. He is also one of the most fascinating Christians of the 20th century, whose Christian testimony, transformed through his writings, both in fiction and in nonfiction, have shaped generations of Christians since. His books, including the 7-volume Chronicles of Narnia, have been well known to children and to adults. Successive generations have read them, loved them, enjoyed them, and have learned so much from C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis was himself a complex personality. His conversion story is one of the great conversion epics of the last century. He was also a keen mind and a phenomenal writer. C.S. Lewis understood the issues of his day. He was a keen analyst of the worldview of his times. He understood the challenge of modernity, and he dearly loved the gospel of Jesus Christ. In various books, including his most famous Christian work, Mere Christianity, he sought to define the Christian reality and to assert the Christian truth claim over against the challenges of modernity. He also, in a very clever way, wanted to communicate spiritual and biblical truth. In his rightly famous work known as the Screwtape Letters, he pictured a conversation through a series of letters between a junior demon and an older devil. That book, perhaps more than anything else C.S. Lewis wrote, reveals the realities of his understanding of the human condition of temptation and sinfulness. In various other, especially nonfiction writings, C.S. Lewis sought to defend particular teachings of the Christian faith, and he fought for and sought to describe a Christian understanding of love. He had first come to try to deal with the reality of love by means of literary study. But he found that in coming to an understanding of love, he had to eventually write of it from a very clearly Christian perspective. And so he did. C.S. Lewis was a very well-known figure not only in British academia and in the world of literature, but also in the British media of the time. But as both an author and as a Christian thinker, C.S. Lewis may well be more popular in America among American evangelicals now than he was among British people and British evangelicals even back during his lifetime. He was a joyful Christian and a complex personality. He was also a literary figure more than a theologian. At several points, his theology simply is not trustworthy. For instance, he espoused something very close to a form of universalism. But C.S. Lewis also gave very intense attention to the development of the Christian mind, understanding, at least in part, and to a greater degree than many of his peers, what that would require and what that would produce. A very real argument can be made that it is C.S. Lewis, rather than John F. Kennedy, who has had the greater and more enduring influence. As a matter of fact, other than in specific speeches, such as his very famous inaugural address of 1961, President Kennedy is not currently well known for having held any specific political convictions, nor of seeking to change the political convictions of the nation. But when it comes to C.S. Lewis, conviction was his main passion, as well as literature. He sought by every available means to try to reach the convictional heart of his readers, and that meant the heart of the culture. 50 years after his death, John F. Kennedy is now primarily remembered in terms of events such as the Cuban Missile Crisis. But C.S. Lewis is primarily known for ideas including what he defined as mere Christianity. But John F. Kennedy and Clive Staples Lewis, C.S. Lewis, were not the only two famous people in the world to die on November the 22nd, 1963. The third was Aldous Huxley, a famous British writer who died on that very same day in Los Angeles. Aldous Huxley was the author of many books, most famously his novel Brave New World. Like George Orwell's book 1984, Brave New World helped to establish the 20th century in terms of its hopes and its horrors, most particularly the horror of the control of the mind by totalitarian states. But as George Orwell argued that totalitarian control would come by force and by mechanisms of coerced control, Aldous Huxley warned that the most likely totalitarian victory would come by form of seduction, using pleasure rather than pain as the main instrument of totalitarian coercion. As a matter of fact, in a letter he wrote to George Orwell in 1949, Huxley wrote that it would be infant conditioning and narco-hypnosis that would be more efficient instruments of government than clubs and prisons, and that the lust for power can be just as completely satisfied by suggesting people into loving their servitude as by flogging and kicking them into obedience. Orwell and Huxley both offered dystopias, that is, warnings about a horrible civilization and society to come. But Huxley seemed to understand something that Orwell did not see. Orwell saw the Soviet Union as the ultimate totalitarian instrument to fear, but Huxley saw even Western governments heading toward the totalitarian temptation, and he saw them using pleasure rather than pain as the main instrument of social control. In a famous passage in Brave New World, Huxley wrote, quote, "A really efficient totalitarian state would be one in which the all-powerful executive of political bosses and their army of managers control a population of slaves who do not have to be coerced because they love their servitude. To make them love it is the task assigned in present-day totalitarian states to ministries of propaganda, newspaper editors, and school teachers, but their methods are still crude and unscientific." Interestingly and prophetically enough, Aldous Huxley saw the coming totalitarianism as based in pleasure, for instance, sexual immorality, an open sexual society. He saw the coming breakdown of the family and the coming culture in which one of the scariest words heard in that culture would be the word mother. He saw a situation in which babies would be produced by reproductive centers without human sexuality, in order for the children to be raised and sorted by their ability into predetermined castes and roles in society. Aldous Huxley was an agnostic openly hostile to Christianity, and he was a very eccentric and indeed odd human being. He considered himself a prototype of what would later be described as a secular humanist, an ideological humanist. John F. Kennedy was a cultural humanist. Aldous Huxley was an ideological humanist. And C.S. Lewis was, by his own self-identification and confession, a Christian thinker. In an odd and eerily symbolic way, the deaths of those three men on the same day, November the 22nd, 1963, set in very clear relief the cultural distinctions and the worldview cleavages that would mark the human experience and Western civilization right down to the present. Catholic writer Peter Kreeft would actually write a book imagining a posthumous conversation between Lewis and Kennedy and Huxley. Well, we can be certain that that posthumous conversation never took place. But we also need to recognize that in our present day, in living human civilization and society, that conversation continues. 50 years after November the 22nd, 1963, on this day, let us all make certain that we ponder these issues. Before this day, November the 22nd, 2013, itself passes into history. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'm speaking to you from Dallas, Texas, and I'll meet you again on Monday for The Briefing.